From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Timothy Phelps was one of two reporters who broke the Anita Hill story, leading to a second set of hearings during the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. On today's Fresh Air, we'll discuss the behind-the-scenes politics that led to Thomas's nomination and confirmation. It's the subject of Phelps' new book, Capital Gains. Also, we remember composer Astor Piazzolla, who died yesterday at the age of 71. Piazzolla created what became known as the New Tango, but in his native Argentina, there was such resistance to tampering with the dance, he became known as the Assassin of the Tango. We'll hear a 1988 interview with him. And critic Maureen Corrigan compares the speeches of Abraham Lincoln and George Bush by way of two new books. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A senior U.S. official said today that the United States is prepared to support U.N. military force if it's needed to break the Serbian siege of Sarajevo. The official, speaking in Munich on condition of anonymity, said that the United States is determined to do everything it can to support the international relief operation in Sarajevo. He said that would include the creation of a land corridor to allow humanitarian supplies to be trucked to the Bosnian capital. The Goldstone Commission, investigating political violence in South Africa, says it has found no evidence indicating that either the government or the security forces were directly involved in the violence. The justice heading the commission described allegations against the security forces as unwise, unfair, and dangerous. The BBC's Tom Carver reports from Johannesburg.
Justice Goldstone's comments appear to be a clear rejection of the ANC's claims about state involvement in the violence. In this already highly volatile atmosphere, this will be seized upon by the government as valuable ammunition in its propaganda war against the ANC. The main reason for the ANC's withdrawal from talks was their claim that President de Klerk and his government were actively carrying out killings, and this statement will do nothing to dissuade the millions of blacks who believe this. If anything, it will only increase the level of bitterness and anger that exists in the townships. Nor will it make Justice Goldstone's job any easier. The residents of Boipatong are already refusing to give evidence to the commission about last month's massacre for fear of suffering police reprisals.
The BBC's Tom Carver. The Clinton campaign has announced that New York Governor Mario Cuomo will have a speaking part at the Democratic National Convention next week. After all, he'll nominate Bill Clinton for president. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Governor Cuomo, who electrified the Democratic Convention in 1984, has been characteristically coy about his role at this year's convention. He had said he wanted no major role and that the high-visibility speeches should be made by other Democratic officials. But for months, Democratic National Party Chairman Ron Brown has said that he wanted Cuomo to have a major part. Cuomo had discussions with both the Clinton camp and Brown over the weekend. Today, the party announced that Cuomo will deliver the nomination speech on Wednesday, July 15th, the third day of the convention. Cuomo considered a run for president himself, but decided against it, saying that state budget problems prevented him from doing so. Cuomo has said he also wasn't interested in the number two position on the Democratic ticket, but recently Clinton has said Cuomo would make a good U.S. Supreme Court justice. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 9 points to close at 3,339. This is NPR. The United Nations Security Council has demanded that Iraq immediately permit UN inspectors to search the agriculture ministry in Baghdad. A UN chemical weapons inspection team led by U.S. Army Major Karen Jansen attempted to enter the building yesterday but was kept out by Iraqi guards. The Security Council said that Iraq is in violation of the Gulf War ceasefire resolutions. Members of the inspection team have been keeping watch on the entrances to the building to make sure that nothing is removed during the standoff. Iowa voters, usually characterized as being independent, have told pollsters that President Bush should drop Dan Quayle as his running mate. From member station WOI in Des Moines, Mark Moran reports.
54% of the Iowans polled by the Des Moines Register say President Bush needs a new running mate. The now infamous potato spelling incident, in which Quayle told a New Jersey student he needed to add an E to the word, came during the second day of surveying for the Iowa poll. While the Register is Iowa's most widely circulated newspaper, political director for the Iowa Republican Party, Will Lynch, says voters don't take the poll seriously.
Dan Quayle's been dealt a number of injustices by the media, blowing very insignificant incidences out of proportion, and most people that do know him and are active politically know and respect him as an intelligent, competent leader in our party.
Republicans convene at their national convention in Houston the middle of next month. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
Defense industry sources said today a French investor group has withdrawn its bid for the missile division of the bankrupt LTV Corporation. LTV has been working on a deal to sell its missile division to the French Thompson CSF Group for $450 million. The proposed sale was part of LTV's plan to emerge from bankruptcy. The plan was opposed by members of Congress who feared the French group would also acquire U.S. missile secrets. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that the Supreme Court has ended its term, reporters and legal scholars have been analyzing how the court was changed by the appointment of Clarence Thomas. My guest, Timothy Phelps, is the co-author of the new book, Capital Games, about the behind-the-scenes politics of the Thomas nomination and confirmation. Phelps played an important part in the process. He was one of two reporters who broke the Anita Hill story, which resulted in a second set of hearings. His article revealing Anita Hill's charges of sexual harassment went on the wire service the evening before Nina Totenberg's interview with Hill was broadcast on NPR. Phelps covers the Supreme Court for New York Newsday, and he paid special attention to Thomas's first term on the bench. He wasn't surprised by Thomas's judicial opinions.
Not one bit. It was clear to me from doing the research for the book, basically, from reading everything that Clarence Thomas had written or spoken in a great volume of speeches, that he was much further to the right than he had been portrayed by the White House during the nomination process.
Mm-hmm. Are there ways that you feel the Bush administration manipulated the press?
I think the press was very much manipulated in this whole process. I think that we were kind of suckered into the what they called in the White House the pinpoint Georgia strategy, the bring yourself up by the bootstraps from racism and poverty angle, along with the seeming contradiction of a conservative coming from that background. And while that was an interesting story, I think that we in the press missed the real stories here, which is the extent of Thomas's ideological radicalness, and also, not many people did a very good job in investigating Clarence Thomas's associations and who he was connected with.
In your research for your new book, did you find out anything that you didn't know before about how Thomas was chosen?
Oh, absolutely. From the accidental to the planned. There was a couple of weeks before the nomination, Clarence Thomas happened to be running in a charity foot race here in Washington with Boyden Gray, the White House counsel, who has the largest role in picking nominees. And they got to talking about quotas and affirmative action and found that they had a great deal of common ground there. So that helped on one front. On another front, we found that Clarence Thomas's ties to the religious right in Washington became very important for him, because John Sununu, the chief of staff of the White House, called judicial point man for these groups here in Washington a few hours after Thurgood Marshall resigned and said, "Who do you want?" And the answer came back, Clarence Thomas.
Now, this isn't a standard thing to do, to call a special interest group and say, "Who do you want?"
Well, it certainly has never been known as being standard before. But this president and to some extent President Reagan in his last term have kind of given these nominations to the far right as the price of their still sometimes wavering support.
What ties did Thomas have to the far right and to the religious right?
Well, we found that in recent years, starting from about 1986 to 1987, that Clarence Thomas had given most of his speeches to groups of the far right and had close personal connections with organizations like Library Court, which is a coalition of pro-life, they call it pro-family organizations with a very conservative social agenda. He had gone to meetings of these organizations, and they had come away well satisfied that he would be a representative of their political agenda if he got on the Supreme Court.
Special interest groups always mobilize around or against the nominee. Was there anything unusual in how the right mobilized around Clarence Thomas?
Well, the right was ready for this one. They got outmaneuvered in 1987 with the nomination of Judge Bork. And while so much attention during this nomination process was paid to the liberal opposition groups opposing Clarence Thomas, the real action we found was on the far right again, where they were spending a war chest of money that they had been amassing ever since 1987. Pat Robertson's organization, The Evangelist, alone spent perhaps $1 million on television ads and other techniques to raise grassroots supports for Clarence Thomas.
You say that Pat Robertson's group, the Christian Coalition, has ties to Clarence Thomas's church.
That's right. It's interesting. Most people thought that because of his background, having been raised by nuns, that he was a practicing Roman Catholic. In fact, he was attending a church in suburban Virginia, an Episcopalian church that is a charismatic church and is also happens to be the national headquarters of the Episcopalian Right to Life movement.
Do you think more should have been made of that connection between his church and the Right to Life movement during the hearing?
It was a very difficult call for the press because, quite naturally, in this country, we're squeamish about paying too much attention or raising too much of a fuss about someone's religious connections. I mean, we all have freedom of religion. I think that probably more should have been paid to it in a careful kind of way because, after all, Thomas was saying that he had no position on abortion.
Timothy Phelps, let's get you into the story. In your book, you write, rumors are unpleasant to deal with, but I have no apologies for scrutinizing a Supreme Court nominee's private life. Why not?
Well, Supreme Court nominations, I believe, are different than other more political posts here in Washington. A Supreme Court justice is appointed for life. And not only that, but their moral authority is really the way in which they help lead this country. And to the extent that they're of poor character, it diminishes the authority of the court and its ability to do its job.
When you say that you had no apologies for scrutinizing the nominee's private life, what were you looking into about Clarence Thomas's life? I mean, one of the controversies had to do with whether he watched a lot of pornography. Was that something that you had heard rumors of, and did you pursue that?
That was not an issue at that time until Anita Hill's testimony. I would say that I would not look into questions about pornography in most situations. I think that actually is a private matter that has no bearing on his service on the court. It only became important after Anita Hill's allegations when she said that he had insisted on discussing pornographic movies with her. The first rumor I looked into, and I wouldn't bring it up here if he hadn't brought it up himself later, was a rumor that Clarence Thomas had been beating his wife, his first wife. And as far as I can tell, this rumor was unfounded. At least there was absolutely no evidence that it was true, and there was some evidence that would tend to point the other way. But while this is a personal matter, I wonder if it had been true, would women want a person sitting on the Supreme Court who was abusive? Now, but I would like to make a distinction here because the charges, the allegations made by Anita Hill, were not personal allegations. They were allegations that something had happened in the workplace. And it's while Clarence Thomas tried to make it sound like this was about his private life during the hearings, they were about what happened in the workplace between an employer, allegedly, and an employee. And in fact, in the offices which are charged with enforcing the laws against sexual harassment.
Now, what are the obstacles to you as a reporter of running with a story like this? I mean, you knew about the charges, but you couldn't just write an article about it.
Right. I felt during the summer that I couldn't write a story saying that an unnamed woman had made charges of sexual harassment about which I did not know the details. I felt it was important to have a name attached to these charges and that person's account of what had happened. When Anita Hill actually made a formal complaint, as it were, to the FBI in a sworn statement, then that raised the level of the allegation to something that we could use.
Mm-hmm. Now, initially, you couldn't call up Anita Hill and ask her about the charges because your source gave you the information under the condition that you not call her and ask her directly about sexual harassment.
That's right. I eventually did call her several weeks before the story ran and found that she was still extremely reluctant to talk to me. She was unsure. She considered it. She kept saying, call me back later this afternoon. I had wanted to fly out to Oklahoma to talk to her. She was just the image of a woman tortured by this decision, quite contrary to the image that many people have gotten of someone who was out to get Clarence Thomas.
And just to clarify, when you did call her to try to talk about it, this was after you had gotten confirmation from a second source that she had these complaints, and that way you felt you could call her without going against your agreement with the first source.
That's right. That's right.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Phelps, author of the new book Capital Games, Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill, and the Story of a Supreme Court Nomination. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Timothy Phelps is my guest. He covers the Supreme Court from New York Newsday, and he broke the story of Anita Hill. When you heard rumors that Thomas had sexually harassed employees, why did you decide to pursue that? Why did you think that this might be something more than just a rumor?
Fairly early on in looking into Clarence Thomas, I became convinced that there was another side to this man. So many of his friends described him as extremely outgoing and extremely jovial and friendly. He certainly had a magnetic personality to some individuals. But I kept coming across things that did not square with that image. He had fired a couple of employees or attempted to transfer them or demote them simply for speaking about problems at the agency to the press. Some of the employees have been fired by having a note taped to their chair. At the same time, I began hearing about connections between Clarence Thomas and a man named Jay Parker, a ultra conservative black PR man in Washington, who had been a lobbyist for South Africa or various South African organizations for some 10 years. And this turned out to be Clarence Thomas's closest friend and his real, true political mentor. And so I seemed all the time to be dealing with two people. One of them, a wonderful, outgoing, jovial man who befriended the people who worked for him, and the other, a very angry man and somewhat vindictive. So perhaps because of those two conflicting images, when I heard about the allegations of sexual harassment, which at that point were just a rumor, I was better predisposed to take them seriously and to look into them.
As a reporter, you were getting a lot of information, as were many other reporters as well, about Clarence Thomas as someone who you perceived as an ideologue. Yet, when he was being questioned at the hearings, that's mm-hmm. not the way he would answer questions. So what were some of the dilemmas that you faced as a reporter during the hearings when you were reporting on Thomas's testimony?
Well, it was a very difficult situation. I actually tried to go back and write a story during the hearings about Clarence Thomas as an ideologue. And the editors would say, well, look, I mean, this doesn't square with what he's saying in the hearings. There was a very successful maneuver by Clarence Thomas and his White House handlers to portray himself as something different than what he had become. And when in the course of doing the research for the book, this puzzle kind of cleared itself up. We put everything he had said and written literally on a timeline. And there you could see the curve, you could see the change. Because when Clarence Thomas first came to Washington, he was truly a moderate conservative. In fact, he got into trouble with the conservative wing of the Republican Party for not working fast enough to dismantle affirmative action. He was almost fired. And perhaps because of that, he kind of began to change his tune. And then later in the process, changed his tune very dramatically. So what seemed like a contradiction between the Clarence Thomas of 1982, 1983, and the Clarence Thomas of later years became more understandable as we put it on this timeline.
On that weekend of the Anita Hill portion of the Clarence Thomas hearings, on Sunday, both Hill and Thomas had panels of witnesses who testified on their behalf. But Anita Hill only had one panel of witnesses, whereas Clarence Thomas had several. And, I mean, there were so many Clarence Thomas
right.
witnesses, it extended
right.
into prime time,
right.
beyond prime time, late into the night. What happened to the rest of the Anita Hill witnesses? How come they never testified?
All through this process, terrible mistakes were being made by the Democratic side and the Hill forces, while the Republicans were extremely adept and astute at getting their message across. Anita Hill had a second panel of witnesses prepared to testify, but the Hill camp itself decided to call them off. First, they made a terrible miscalculation that they were winning this battle, both in the Senate and in the polls. After Anita Hill's first panel of witnesses testified that she had told them about sexual harassment years before, and after Hill's announcement that she had taken a polygraph test and had passed, the Hill camp said, "Well, we're ahead. We don't need to do this." There were problems with their second panel. There were indications that the Republicans, who were really playing hardball at this point, were going to ask personal questions to members of the panel that would embarrass them.
What kinds of personal questions?
Well, about perhaps sexual orientation, other kinds of questions about their awareness of what process had taken place in terms of releasing the story to the press. There were just questions that they didn't want to face. Alan Simpson had been flapping his coat saying, "I'm getting things over the transom." And they decided that they were ahead and they didn't need to go through that process. Of course, they were wrong.
Do you think the witnesses wouldn't have been able to hold their own against the question, against those questions?
Oh, I think perhaps they would have, and I think they would have helped. The other witness who was not called, and this was a decision of the Judiciary Committee, was Angela Wright, the other woman who was prepared to testify that she, too, had been sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas. She's a newspaper editor in North Carolina, and she had somewhat similar experiences while working for Clarence Thomas shortly after Anita Hill left the EOC. And she even had a backup witness of her own, an older lady named Rose Jordan, who had worked with both of them and was prepared to say that, yes, Angela Wright had come into my office in tears after leaving the chairman's office because of what he had said to her. The Democrats never called the two of them. The reason, as near as we could find, was that they'd been kind of bamboozled by the Republicans into thinking that there was something wrong with Angela Wright. Alan Simpson was going around saying, I've got the goods on her.
What happens if sometime down the line it's discovered, this is hypothetical, it's discovered that the allegations of sexual harassment against Clarence Thomas were true? What would happen?
Well, I asked Senator Specter this question on Nightline a few days after Justice Thomas was confirmed, and he said that that he thought that impeachment would be possible. There is some debate among constitutional scholars as to whether or not you can impeach a justice for something he did before he went on the Supreme Court, and some say yes and some say no. But I think that the Senate itself would be so outraged if it was proven that these charges were true that that there certainly would be a move in that direction.
I wonder if you know if there are still people investigating the charges against Clarence Thomas.
Well, I certainly am. I know of...
You still are?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm not on any vendetta here, and I don't intend to write a lot of stories out of this investigation. But I think that it's the responsibility of the press to find out what happened. I mean, after all, either a justice of the Supreme Court committed perjury in order to get there, or a unprecedented illegal campaign to sabotage this nomination took place, including an awful lot of perjury. So I think that this is something that we can't let lie.
It must be very hard to investigate someone who was a Supreme Court justice.
Well, I think it was very difficult to investigate even someone who was
nominated, yeah.
Because so many people felt that all the power and wrath of Washington would come down on them if they talked, and certainly it would even be heightened now. But I'm hopeful that over time, as things quiet down, that sources who may know the truth will come forward or at least be more willing to talk.
Timothy Phelps covers the Supreme Court for New York Newsday. His new book about the Clarence Thomas appointment is Capital Games. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Composer Astor Piazzolla was at the forefront of the tango revival. He created what was known as the New Tango, a blend of the traditional tango with classical music, jazz, and rock. But when he started playing his new tangos in the mid-50s in his native Argentina, he was sometimes physically assaulted by tango lovers who were outraged by this new form. Astor Piazzolla died yesterday at the age of 71. Coming up, we remember him with a 1988 interview. Also, Maureen Corrigan compares the speeches of George Bush to Abraham Lincoln with the help of two new books. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Leaders of the seven big industrialized democracies have ended their first day of summit talks in Munich. Much of their time was focused on the situation in Bosnia. NPR's John Edstey reports.
Over dinner this evening, the heads of state spent a good deal of time talking about the situation in Yugoslavia. President Bush's National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft said the leaders reiterated their concern about the situation in Bosnia and the determination to keep humanitarian aid flowing. Scowcroft said there was discussion about the utility of an international conference on Yugoslavia. The leaders appear to be moving toward a strong declaration, not ruling out the use of force to ensure the delivery of humanitarian aid to Bosnia. A senior U.S. official said today that if the current U.N. effort to deliver humanitarian aid is hampered by the warring parties, the United States would support a new U.N. resolution authorizing the use of military means to ensure delivery. I'm John Edstein in Munich.
In South Africa, a government-appointed commission says it has found no evidence of government involvement in the murders of more than 40 people in a black township last month. However, at the same time, the panel said the government of President F.W. de Klerk had ignored earlier proposals on ways to stop the violence that has claimed thousands of lives. The African National Congress has blamed both de Klerk and police for recent violence and has suspended talks with the government in protest. According to U.S. government scientists, the Earth is cool by 1 degree Fahrenheit since last year's eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, and the Northern Hemisphere cooled even more than that. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Mount Pinatubo poured some 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, and because these acidic droplets block sunlight, many scientists predicted that the Earth would cool temporarily. Satellite temperature measurements by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration show that, sure enough, temperatures around the world have dropped since the eruption 13 months ago. In the Northern Hemisphere, they've fallen 1.5 degrees on average, and scientists predict they could drop by a total of 2 degrees over the next year and a half. That may not sound like a lot, but 2 degrees is how much the Earth has heated up over the past century. The trend isn't expected to last, though. Once those volcanic particles clear out of the air, the temperatures should return to normal in 1995 or so. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
In New York City, the UN Security Council has demanded that Iraq allow UN inspectors to search the government's agriculture ministry for weapons information. A 16-member team has been keeping watch in the building for 2 days now after being barred entrance. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 9 points to close at 3,339.21 on volume of 186 million shares. This is NPR News. In spite of apparent differences in the past, New York Governor Mario Cuomo will give the nominating speech for Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton at next week's Democratic convention in New York City. Campaign officials say it appears now that Clinton will name his vice presidential choice sometime between this Wednesday and next Monday. Clinton is said to have not made up his mind about a choice for a running mate and spent much of this past weekend considering his choices. Among those mentioned as being under serious consideration are Senators Albert Gore, Bob Kerrey, and Harris Wofford, along with Congressman Lee Hamilton. The Republican governor of Massachusetts traveled to Arkansas today in a bid to keep up the heat on Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton. Ben Fry of member station KUAR reports.
President Bush's reelection team sent Massachusetts Governor William Weld to Little Rock today to blast Bill Clinton's environmental record. With Governor Clinton's improved showing in the polls, The president's reelection campaign has stepped up attacks against the Democratic candidate on his home turf. Quoting a barrage of statistics, Weld says that Arkansas ranks last in environmental initiatives and 42nd in the number of polluted streams and rivers. Weld also labeled the Arkansas governor a tax and spend fanatic, saying he raised taxes and fees 128 times since taking office. Clinton spokesperson Dee Dee Myers, who sat in on the news conference, says the Republicans are trying to avert people's attention from the real issue of how to restore America's economic strength. Myers refuted most of Weld's assertions, saying the Republican governor didn't get his facts right. For National Public Radio, I'm Ben Fry in Little Rock.
A bomb exploded in northern Iraq near a motorcade carrying the wife of French President Mitterrand, and four people were killed. Before the bombing, Mrs. Mitterrand's three-day trip had been sharply criticized by the Iraqi government. She was not injured in the attack, which came during a visit to Kurdish refugees. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Astor Piazzolla, the world's foremost contemporary tango composer, died yesterday at the age of 71. He had suffered a stroke 2 years ago. Piazzolla was at the forefront of the tango revival, yet he was no revivalist. His music was known as the New Tango, a hybrid of traditional tango, classical music, jazz, and rock. His music caught on in America through his records and through his compositions in the Broadway hit Tango Argentina. But in the 1950s, when Piazzolla started performing his new tangos in his native Argentina, he was verbally and physically attacked as if he had committed an act of treason. Piazzolla was born in 1921. At the age of 3, he moved with his parents to New York, where he remained until he returned to Argentina as a teenager. We're going to hear an interview I recorded with Piazzolla in 1988. First, some music from his album Zero Hour. You'll hear Piazzolla on bandoneon, an instrument similar to an accordion, but instead of a keyboard on one side, there are buttons on both sides. When I spoke with Piazzolla, he told me about the state of the tango in 1954 when he started performing his new tangos in Argentina.
It was going out. I mean, there was a very big invasion of Elvis Presley and rock music and boleros from Mexico. Bill Haley was invading also Argentina with his music. And the young Argentinians, 15, 16, the teenagers of my country, started listening to this more exciting music and not that boring tango that they have been playing during 50 or 60 years in Argentina. So the young people wanted more electricity in their veins, and they chose American music. And then after they chose English music. But the new tango, the one I play, fortunately, it's the people of rock and roll who love my music, the people who like modern jazz, or the people who like to listen to Bela Bartok or Stravinsky. That's the people who follow my music.
Now, you got the nickname the Assassin of the Tango when you started playing the new tango. Were there actually threats against you by people who were very upset with you for having taken the traditional tango and made something else of it?
Yes, yes. The telephones, menaces, and my family and me, and they used to call me on the phone and say they would wait for me in the streets, and they would give me a beating. Why? Just because I changed the tango. But I didn't change the tango. What I changed is the way of playing and the way of writing. I mean, I gave it a new dimension, harmonically speaking and with rhythmically speaking.
So you had people who were literally calling you up and threatening on the telephone, trying to pick fights with you because of your new tango music. Why do you think that your music caused such a violent reaction? I mean, people like music, they dislike music, but they don't necessarily want to try to kill the composer of the music they dislike.
Number one, the people couldn't dance with my music. The dancers of tango hated me. They detested Astor Piazzolla. You can't dance with Astor Piazzolla. The singers of Argentina detested me. They hated my music because it wasn't singing music. Nobody sang my music.
Did you hear many tangos when you were growing up?
Well, I was born playing John Sebastian Bach on the bandoneon because it sounds more like an organ as the instrument. My teacher, I had a very important piano concert player. His name was Bela Wilda. He was Hungarian, and he taught me to play old classical music and the bandoneon. I never played a tango when I was small.
Did you hate tango like a lot of children growing up hate their parents' music?
Well, I hated to do what my father wanted, but my father suddenly started loving John Sebastian Bach, and he was next to me. He was my friend. He was the one who insisted that I should play classical music. He loved more that his son would be a classical musician than a popular tango musician.
Did you start playing tangos at all when you were in New York?
I started in 1934, yes, with Carlos Gardel. He was a very important singer from Argentina. He came to New York to... he made three films in New York and Long Island with John Reinhardt as a director. And I played the music in the tango music in the film and while he was singing. And that's how I started my career as a tango musician.
That was just a couple of years after that that you moved back to Argentina, right?
In 1937, before the war, my father got scared and we went all back to Argentina. And I started my musical career when I was 18 years old, between 17 and 18 years old in the city of Buenos Aires. I left Mar del Plata. And I started with the best orchestras. That's when I received my first crash as a tango musician. I started all of a sudden to love tango, and all the education, the classical education I had. Imagine, I used to play Rhapsody in Blue of Gershwin on the bandoneon. I used to play Sophisticated Lady of Ellington, and the people used to look at me as if I was a Martian. I mean, you can never find a bandoneon player in Argentina. I don't know if today if someone exists who could play the Rhapsody in Blue or...
You also studied piano, right?
Yes, I studied piano and composition. I studied everything in music.
Well, I want to play an excerpt from the album that introduced you to many Americans. The album is called Zero Hour, and it's on the American Clave record. And this is another composition of yours. This is called Concerto for a Quintet. And let's listen.
Thank you.
Music by Astor Piazzolla. More of our 1988 interview after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1988 interview with Astor Piazzolla, who died yesterday at the age of 71. Piazzolla studied with Nadia Boulanger in Paris. Many composers have stories about how she changed their lives and their music. Piazzolla had a story like that.
When I arrived to Paris in 54 with all my music, I thought I was a genius because I wrote 20 symphonies and 20 sonatas and so many chamber music pieces. And all of a sudden, Nadia Boulanger, in one afternoon in 3 or 4 hours, looks all over my music and says, "This is good for nothing. Throw it away because I can't find Astor Piazzolla." And she wanted to know which is my real profession as a musician. I was very ashamed to tell her that I played in a nightclub. In those moments, I was playing in a cabaret, not a nightclub. It's too refined to say a nightclub. It was a cabaret in Buenos Aires. I played there, and I studied at the same time. And she says, "You play tango." "Oh, that's beautiful. I love tango." And now she's going to ask me if I play piano or what I play. And I have to tell her I play bandoneon. It's worse. So I told her, "Look, I don't play piano. I'm not a pianist. I'm a very bad pianist. I play bandoneon." "Oh, bandoneon, that's beautiful. I love that instrument. I can hear that in Kurt Weill's music, and I can hear that also in Boris Blacher, and all famous German composers use the bandoneon in symphonic orchestras." So she gave me this strength to believe in myself. She was like my second mother. She spoke to me like my mother never spoke to me. She taught me to believe in myself. And since that moment, I started believing in myself and in tango music also, above all.
So you kind of really needed her permission to write in your own voice.
Yes, I needed her permission. She was the only one. I needed somebody that was superior. And she was really superior to everybody. And she loved my music. She loved my tango music. She heard it. And she said, "This is Astor Piazzolla. Please, don't ever leave it."
You know, tango is, at least to us Americans, associated with horror houses and clubs and things like that. I don't know so what about clubs, but...
You forgot Hernando's Hideaway.
Right, sure. That's right. But did you go through a period like that when you were in Argentina before you started composing the new tangos and giving recitals as opposed to playing for dancers? Well, did you go through a period of playing in whorehouses at all?
Well, yes, I played. I'm a normal man. I mean, I played in whorehouses since I was 18. I played when I was 45. I played, that was the last one, in 1963 or 64. But one day, only 2 days. I mean, I wasn't employed as a musician to play in whorehouses or bordels. I just played those 2 days, and it was something I really didn't know, but I had much fun because I was considered as a very exponent of a cultural music in Argentina, and all of a sudden I found myself playing in a whorehouse. So that was very funny for me.
You know, the tango is also a dance associated with this real macho ethic. Is that true? I mean, you've actually play tangos, you're not looking at it at a distance. Is it really associated with a very macho style?
Yes, it's a way of making love. I found out of this action when I was only 18 or 19 years old. I was seeing the people dancing when I was playing not with my orchestra, with other orchestras I used to play with. And I used to see how they were so compenetrated of what they were dancing. They danced with their eyes closed as if they were dreaming. And it was the man and the woman at the same time. And at the same time, they made love. And it was so strange. I was so young, and I was looking at this as discovering something I never saw in my life.
Let me ask you, are there any American real schlocky interpretations of tangos that you get a real kick out of now?
Well, I think that not only Americans, I think the fault is of the Europeans, the Germans and the French and the Italians, who had an idea, of what really tango was. And that spread that came to our United States, and when Louis Armstrong used to play I Get Ideas, and when other musicians played Hernando's Hideaway, that was really a kick in the liver when I heard Hernando's Hideaway. That was terrible. And the Argentines were furious because that was making fun of what really was our tango was. I mean, our tango is something completely different. I insist, when somebody really knows how to dance, and when they dance the tango profoundly as they feel it, you can see that it's like making love. I mean, it's as if nobody was looking at them, and it's something you'd really love. That's why they dance that way.
Composer Astor Piazzolla from a 1988 Fresh Air interview. Piazzolla died yesterday in Buenos Aires at the age of 71. Here's more music. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Welcome back after the holiday.
Then to you.
We have today a story by NPR's John McChesney about EDS, H. Ross Perot's company, the one that he created and made him very wealthy, about the culture of EDS. Some people remember it as the ideal corporation and the ideal employer. Others remember an atmosphere that was not at all pleasant to work with. Also today, we'll be talking with Deborah Scroggins, a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, about her series Women of the Veil, about women in several Muslim countries and the very, very restricted life they lead because of Islam.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Commentator Maureen Carrigan has a review of two new books about two presidents, one who had a way with words and one whose words run away with him.
On November 19, 1863, President Abraham Lincoln gave a public speech that lasted a mere 3 minutes, roughly the length of this commentary. By the time Lincoln finished delivering the Gettysburg Address, he not only had ushered in a modern style of political speaking, but he also had called into being a new nation on the site of one of the Civil War's most gruesome battlefields. Approximately 15,000 people heard Lincoln that day, and according to some accounts, many were disconcerted with his abrupt performance. After all, the Harvard orator, Edward Everett, had just enthralled the crowd for 2 hours. And what's even more amazing, Everett, as usual, had memorized his speech. Other popular myths have Lincoln scribbling the Gettysburg Address on a piece of cardboard or an envelope on the train from Washington, or even mentally composing it as he listened to Everett. But Gary Will's new book, Lincoln at Gettysburg, debunks these myths and instead gives us a more credible and more impressive story about the Gettysburg Address, the story of how Lincoln distilled a lifetime of intellectual, literary, and political labors into the poetry of those fateful 272 words. First of all, Wills tells us that history has wrongly caricatured poor Everett as a champion windbag. In fact, he was delivering the official oration, which was supposed to go on and on. Everett's bad luck was simply that his ornate style of rhetoric immediately became obsolete the minute Lincoln opened his mouth. Wills shows how Lincoln's fascination with the newly invented telegraph contributed to the insistent staccato beat of the address. For instance, the first 3 sentences of the second paragraph begin like this: "We are engaged, we are met, we have come." Not an adverb or adjective in sight. Wills also demonstrates how Lincoln drew on classical rhetoric, biblical vocabulary, and the nature imagery of the rural cemetery movement. He shows how Lincoln's reference to government of, by, and for the people was a calculated choice of words. It was influenced by Lincoln's interpretation of the Declaration of Independence as a document that created one people rather than a union of states. The prose style of Wills' book surely would have pleased Lincoln himself. It's precise, elegant, and moving. Wills manages to unravel the strands of the Gettysburg Address without dissolving its magic. It's chilling to consider what Lincoln would have thought of George Bush's speaking style. But we know Bush admires Lincoln. At least I think he tried to say so in this statement during the New Hampshire primary. You cannot be president of the United States if you don't have faith. Remember Lincoln going to his knees in times of trial and the Civil War and all that stuff. You can't be, and we are blessed. So don't feel sorry for, don't cry for me, Argentina. Ay. The editors of the New Republic magazine have gathered together 100 of these so-called Bushisms, fractured non-sentences habitually sputtered by our commander-in-chief. I guarantee, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or other, you won't know whether to laugh or cry. The negative spin on Bush speak offered by Michael Kinsley is that Bush babbles because he doesn't have anything to say. But maybe the best way to read Bushisms is in the generous spirit of Lincoln, with malice toward none and charity for all.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Lincoln at Gettysburg by Gary Wills and Bushisms compiled by the editors of the New Republic. Gary Wills will be our guest on tomorrow's Fresh Air. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Audrey Voblaitis. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, political rhetoric. Gary Wills' new book analyzes how Lincoln's Gettysburg Address changed the history of American political thought. We'll talk with Wills about his book, Lincoln at Gettysburg, and about his recent critical profile of Ross Perot. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.